Hey, Worldly fans. Are you going to be in Austin for South by Southwest? If so, I'd love to invite you to join me for a live tape-in of the Ezra Klein Show. I'll be at the Deep End by Vox Media on Sunday, March 11th at 3:30, talking with Melinda Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We're going to be talking about the work they do, about the state of public health worldwide, about what is and isn't getting better in the world. I'm very excited to have this conversation. The work they do is important, and it is controversial, and it is interesting, and it is making a lot of lives better, and there's a lot around that to dig into. So I think that's going to be a very good episode, and you should come see it. The Deep End by Vox Media. We are taking over the Belmont for a three-day event at South by Southwest. Again, that is from March 9 to March 11th. And it isn't just me. You're going to get live podcasts from many Vox Media Podcast Network favorites, including Kara Swisher's Recode Decode, The Verge's Vergecast. But again, you can join me for a live taping the Ezra Klein Show on Sunday, March 11th at 3:30 for a conversation with Melinda Gates. To request an invitation, go to voxmedia.com/SXSW-2018. Again, that is voxmedia.com/SXSW-2018. I know that is super memorable, but again, SXXW-2018, and I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Hello, it is I, a Russian agent. I come to steal election.
Welcome to Worldly, Vox's weekly guide to the most important stories in the world, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. So, special counsel Bob Mueller is investigating whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. And he keeps indicting Trump aides as he fills in the blanks of what those Trump aides might have actually done. But now he's filling in the blanks of what the Russians did, with new indictments alleging they went to almost comically elaborate lengths to help Trump win.
The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election. The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general.
So that was Rod Rosenstein, Mueller's boss, the deputy attorney general. And he's talking about the indictments of 13 people and three companies, which we'll get into in 1 second. But there was one person he didn't name. And to use a legal term, it is the biggest unindicted co-conspirator. And his name is Vladimir Putin. So, Jen, let's dive in. What was in the Mueller indictments that's new and that changes what we know about what Russia did?
Right. So we already knew kind of in general that Russia, that these group called the Internet Research Agency, right, they had bots, they created kind of social media accounts. We knew kind of in general. So the Mueller indictments gave us some really specific details about what's going on. It was really fascinating. So this group of Russians essentially came to the U.S. They impersonated U.S. persons. So they acted like they were actual Americans and pretended. They contacted people related to the Trump campaign, but they also contacted like grassroots political organizations. And they set up all these fake social media accounts, so on Facebook, on Instagram, and others. And they basically created these pages intended to kind of sow political discord more generally. So they created pages, for example, along the lines of like the Black Lives Matter movement. One was called Blacktivist. They had one that was the Heart of Texas. It was basically this like Texas independence secession movement. And they got like tens and thousands of followers. They also staged rallies, both for and actually against Trump, at one point even on the same day in New York, one for Trump and one saying Trump is not my president. And they essentially basically put out all this kind of content over and over again. They pushed these hashtags, including hashtag Trump train, hashtag Hillary for prison. And there was one really bizarre one. At one point, they literally hired someone, an American, to dress up like Hillary Clinton in a black and white prison jumpsuit in a cage at a rally. So that's how kind of detailed it really got.
I mean, that's what struck me in some ways was how granular they became in their activities. And also, we'll talk about this a little bit further in, but they weren't just meddling ultimately in the presidential race. They were getting down to like individual house races. So they had knowledge of the American political system that, frankly, is better than I think a lot of Americans have. But, Zach, there were a lot of unknown, unpronounceable Russian names in this. And then there was one name that really matters. And he is nicknamed Putin Chef. He is not actually a chef. But who is this guy?
Well, he's sort of a chef. His name is Yevgeny Prigozhin. And he's an old buddy of Putin's from their St. Petersburg days. That's where Putin came up in the Russian political system. And Prigozhin was kind of a thug. He was arrested for, among other things, child prostitution. But then he became a restaurateur, starting with a hot dog stand and moving on up. And
as one does.
Right, yeah, as one does. Do. It's a natural career progression.
And in the process, he made friends with Vladimir Putin, at the time working in St. Petersburg, and would host Putin and his friends for dinners at his restaurants. And in general came to be kind of Putin's his dirty tricks guy, maybe his Roger Stone, if you want to use a U.S. politics analogy. And so Prigozhin was the guy who masterminded, apparently, a lot of this social media hacking campaign to the point where some Russian operatives posed in front of the White House for a photo thanking their boss, Prigozhin, for all of his work.
Right. But I think what they actually had in that photo was so amazing because they posed a couple days before his birthday standing in front of the White House and the sign said, "Happy 55th birthday, dear boss." It's just amazing. We're talking, you know, Jen's made the point about the person in the Hillary suit. These guys holding up like not just a trolling online, but a literal physical trolling. Prigozhin is interesting because beyond this, he was also somebody who is thought to have helped fund what Russia is doing in Syria to help Assad. He's also someone that is thought to help fund what's happening in eastern Ukraine, where Russia did this like wink nod invasion. There was a columnist for The Post who described him as, since the Russians in Ukraine are called the little green men, that he's the jolly green giant. But what's interesting to me is that his ties to Putin are so extraordinarily close. And there is this question hanging over the Trump-Russia investigation from the beginning of, is it actually Russia, as in Vladimir Putin, and Trump, as in President Trump, or is it lower down? And Putin does not appear by name anywhere in this. This is not Putin did this, Putin did this. But it is really hard to believe that a guy as close to him as Prigozhin somehow miraculously was doing this without talking to or getting direction from Vladimir Putin.
Right. I mean, the U.S. intelligence assessment about the hacking that came out in January of last year suggested that Putin probably greenlit the entire operation, right? That was their assessment because this was such an important and large-scale operation that it likely would not have been put into motion without approval of, you know, the guy who makes the decisions in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, there's not a lot that goes on in Russia that Putin doesn't know about. So what I think is fascinating, though, too, if you're sitting there going, like I was, like, well, how did this restaurateur become really good at, like, getting into the United States political system and doing all this crazy social media stuff? The Wall Street Journal had a piece on him. So in 2011, his company, Concord Catering, right, because he's this restaureateur, had a government...
What a benign name for, like, a creepy spy.
Concord Catering, right?
Yeah, it sounds like I want them to do my wedding.
Nothing to see here, folks.
Note, I have a different caterer for my wedding, not Russian spies. Go on.
That's what you think. Yeah, so his Concord Catering, this company, had a really lucrative government contract in Russia to provide school lunches. And all of a sudden, the kids wouldn't eat the food because it was bad and rotten because it turns out, you know, he cut some corners on the school lunches. So there's this, like, huge public outcry, right? So he got all these people, these employees, he hired young men and women to overwhelm the internet with comments saying, like, publicly that this is good and kind of basically drowning out the negative press. So essentially, like, in the American context, he basically hired a bunch of people to go on Yelp and give, like, good reviews. And so that was, like, his kind of first foray into how to use the internet to completely swarm and overwhelm and kind of dominate the political conversation, basically just because he was really shitty at catering school lunches.
But when we're talking about the two leaders who ostensibly are the heads of this, right, if we're talking about collusion, so you've got Vladimir Putin on the Russian side, Donald Trump on the American side, it is so hard to imagine two leaders who are less the same. You could imagine Vladimir Putin sitting in meetings for 12 hours and being briefed by his buddy, the former chef, on every detail of this and probably chuckling at some of the hashtags and the photos, but just really taking the details.
Right.
And you can't imagine Donald Trump sitting for more than 20 minutes in a briefing. And that's only if he's getting briefed with things that involve photos and paragraphs that begin with his name. And I'm not saying that just as a joke, but I am saying that as it is hard to imagine that the Russia side did not happen at the direction of the Russian government. It is not as hard to imagine that the Trump side may not have involved Donald Trump. And we'll get to that a little bit further in. But Putin rules his country because of oligarchs. Putin's whole power structure is he has rich people whose wealth depends on him, whose power depends on him, and they do what he wants them to do. And, you know, Jen, that's why I was so struck as you're describing kind of how he got from, like, failed caterer to Putin. Part of it is he's loyal to Putin. And Putin wants that.
Right. And that's one of the important things when you're kind of thinking more broadly about the Russia kind of investigation. You'll see all these characters kind of pop up, right? So there's the Russian lawyer that was involved in the now notorious Trump Tower meeting with Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner and others. You know, we describe her as, like, Kremlin linked, right? She doesn't necessarily work directly for the Kremlin, but you have to understand the context of Russia. Most of these people, even if they're not directly paid by the government, they're very closely tied. So especially these oligarchs. But I mean, pretty much anyone kind of who has power and wealth and influence is going to be taking directions from Putin and is going to be watched very closely by Putin. So it's not a direct one-to-one, like you can prove this direct connections. You can't say like this Kremlin lawyer or this Kremlin chef, right? Like he's not working at the behest of the government officially. And that's how Putin is able to kind of have his fingers in everything, right? It's plausible deniability. So he can say like, no, of course I didn't do that. I was just a restaurateur guy. It wasn't me. Yeah, sure, unless you know literally anything about Russia. And then it's like, of course Putin's behind this.
And then you've got Prigozhin, who doesn't really seem to give a fuck about being indicted. His quote, which I loved, was, "I'm not at all disappointed that I appear in this list. If they want to see the devil, let them." Because, of course, you're going to say that when you're a vaguely thuggish oligarch.
It's just crazy. I mean, the entire Russian response more generally, right? So the foreign ministry spokesperson came out and was basically making fun of the indictments, right? So 13 individuals and three businesses were included in these first kind of round of indictments. And they came out with a statement, the Russians, and said, oh, really? Just 13 people? So 13 people co-opted your entire elections? Yeah, okay, that's adorable. Really? Maybe you should work on your elections, right? Yeah, you know, if you're a regular kind of person looking in there, you're like, oh, yeah, just 13 people. Except that if you actually look at what they did, like they had millions of dollars behind them. They had tens of thousands, even up to hundreds of thousands of kind of followers, this massive influence online. But the Russians are able to just kind of blow this off. And their broader kind of point and their argument throughout has been this is Russophobia. This is just anti-Russian sentiment. This is all fake news, right? They can kind of get away with that because, again, Putin has that plausible deniability.
Well, what I think is interesting about this isn't just that it was, you know, centrally directed through these oligarch channels. It's also that it was smartly done. Like you run through all of those different scenarios and different tactics that they used, you know, staging rallies that were dueling so there could be conflict and chaos that would make the election look violent or less democratic than it was. And doing so, manipulating causes like Black Lives Matter, that requires a fairly granular understanding of how American politics works. And I doubt that ordinary Russian oligarchs are that sophisticated about it, which to me raises the bigger picture Trump question, which is how do they get this knowledge? It is possible that the Russians employed somebody who's a specialist on American politics. It's possible that they have a really good understanding of how U.S. elections work. It is also possible that someone on the Trump campaign, someone like, say, Paul Manafort, who has a long, long history of working with Russians in elections, was talking to Russians who meddle in elections.
Well, I mean, it's a big charge, right? And that's kind of a big leap beyond where we currently are. It's certainly possible. I think that it is also possible because the indictment talks us through in some detail when it talks about unwitting participants in this, that someone who on the receiving end, some American political consultant thinking he was talking or she was talking to another American, provided this information innocently. I mean, there's a lot about this that is certainly shady and there's a lot of smoke. Our colleague Matt Iglesias wrote a piece on Vox.com sort of arguing that the case for collusion keeps getting stronger. Collusion isn't a legal term, A, and B, you do still have to make some jumps to get to Trump cooperated with Russia in a direct way. And I think the big thing Mueller is obviously investigating is that exact question. And some of the details that keep coming out are so amazing. You know, Zach, you're talking about Paul Manafort. There was a story on Wednesday that Mueller's looking into whether Manafort traded house loans to get a job, where he would say to the guy giving him the loan, hey, I'll get you a job in the White House if you give me this money. It gets shadier and shadier. But whether it gets to Paul Manafort was then knowingly helping Russia, it's still a bit of a jump beyond where we are.
I think it's also important to note, like, what was kind of interesting in these indictments, that it wasn't just Trump. So part of this was also to discredit Hillary Clinton and by doing that, thereby support Trump. But I think the Black Lives Matter piece especially is really interesting. So they set up these Blacktivist accounts, right, and other Black Lives Matter accounts and use those accounts to say, hey, go vote for Jill Stein, you know, the Green Party candidate. There were also parts of the indictment where they talked about supporting Bernie Sanders. So it was also just the kind of granular knowledge of like how to split off the African-American vote from Hillary Clinton is just really fascinating. And there was kind of this big like brouhaha when the indictments first came out about like, oh, you know, did Bernie Sanders collude with the Russians, right? And there's no evidence whatsoever that there was any contact there in the way that there seems to have been with as the indictments say, unwitting members of the Trump campaign, right? But it was just fascinating because it was this broader kind of meddling. Like, yes, part of it was to get Trump elected, but they also just really didn't like Hillary Clinton and didn't want her. And they also just wanted to sow broader political discord, right? You know, one of the points that Trump made recently, and I will have to say that I agree, oddly enough, is that they succeeded beyond just getting Trump elected, right? They succeeded. If you look at, you know, we have congressional probes, we have, you know, the Mueller probe. This has been a super disruptive part of our political kind of life during the election and after. And I think just honestly, Putin just succeeded beyond probably his wildest imagining.
Well, U.S. intelligence does think that the primary goal was to create this kind of disruption that you were just talking about. In fact, at one point, the Russians concluded that Trump probably couldn't win and focused more on delegitimizing Clinton. Well, surprise, Trump won. They were surprised, too. But I also want to go back to the broader question of, like, what does this tell us about possible Trump collusion? And it's instructive here to compare this case of election meddling to another foreign election the Russians meddled in, specifically the French presidential election. They tried fairly hard to get Marine Le Pen, the French far-right candidate, elected. She had literally taken a loan from a Moscow bank. Like, she was very, very pro-Russian, even more so than Trump. And they thought she would be, you know, a serious blow to the EU. And so they went after Emmanuel Macron, her opponent. But the way in which they went after Macron was so unsubtle and so dumb. So, for example, they had Russian propaganda networks saying that he was secretly gay and secretly funded by the gay lobby. He also was a Saudi agent and also an American agent. Like, these are not things that have
– he contains multitudes.
Yeah, it's like the whole thing is weird. There's no consistent message. It's not something that's likely to resonate with the French electorate. It's clumsy. And they did other things. They got into his email, but they didn't do a very good job at publicizing emails that really disrupted his campaign. And in the U.S. case, when they got emails, they published them at precise times that were designed to interfere with major events in the electoral campaign, like the Democratic Convention or the Access Hollywood tape. If you look at those two things, one of these was much more strategic and targeted than the other one.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, if you're Russia and you look around the world and you think, like, where should I devote most of my resources, you're going to just automatically go to the U.S., right? Like, it makes sense to be like, we should probably be more targeted. And, oh, yeah, we could also, like, do some shit in France.
No,
like,
but this isn't a matter of divided resources. The U.S. election was well before the French election in this case. They invested hugely. They've given tons of money to Marine Le Pen. And the French election also is a big deal for them because France is a major EU power and Russia's wanted to disrupt EU and NATO for quite some time. It's been a principal foreign policy goal. This wasn't an ancillary America is more important thing. Like, I just don't think that's right.
I mean, it's also the case that Russian intelligence for decades has been focused wholly on, not wholly in a literal sense, but their biggest priority by far was understanding American politics.
Right.
So that they
the
would
Cold
know
War,
more.
Like,
right. I mean, that they would know more about America than France is not at all surprising.
Right.
I've been thinking a lot about that because I just saw this sort of crappy movie called Red Sparrow with Jennifer Lawrence.
The book is great, though.
Book is great. I'm finishing it now. But it has a lot about Russian intelligence, and they are so focused on the U.S. That part doesn't surprise me. I do think the question is, because I agree with you, clearly some Americans were helping them understand congressional races, clearly. But then the question is, who were those Americans and did they know it was helping Russia? And I feel like those are sort of the specific questions that are the next iteration of this. Like what Mueller is doing is so methodical and so painstaking, right? He's, you know, Zach, you wrote about this for Vox.com. It's like going after a mafia boss. You know, you go after the little people, you flip them. Next people, you flip them. And he goes after specific questions, right? Like this man is exacting. And I think the next questions he's going to try to answer are not Trump. Like they're not the big, big, big ones. The next ones will be the smaller level. Who are the Americans who cooperated? Did they know? Were they part of the Trump campaign? And I think as we're looking ahead, we should look to the little questions that get answered because that will be the first step to the big question getting answered. For Elsewhere this week, we are going to pivot to Israel and to Jerusalem and more specifically to the future of one of the longest serving leaders in Israeli history, arguably one of the most important leaders in the entire Middle East, which is Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's because Israeli police have recommended that he be indicted for two really comically wondrous corruption cases, one that involves taking hundreds of thousands of dollars of gifts, cigars, champagne, money from someone who is an American Hollywood producer. The other involves trying to trade approval of a law that would help a media company to get better coverage from that media company. Netanyahu denies all of it, and this is a little bit of what he says when he does.
כי אני בטוח Sha'emet sofa lenatzeach. Toda rabba.
So putting my Jewish education to a good test, that's Netanyahu in Hebrew saying, these will be proven false. I'm going to keep running the government until they happen. I'm not stepping down. But Zach, let's dive into these a little bit because these cases are wonderful. So case 1000, case 2000, go.
So case 1000 is a series of foreign businessmen, including but not limited to Mariah Carey's Australian ex-husband, sending personal gifts to the Netanyahu family.
Who among us hasn't received gifts from Mariah Carey's ex-husband?
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly not me. But they're like specifically tailored to their interests, right? Like fancy cigars because Bibi likes cigars, right, in his brand. And it's just – it's very clear that these business people were funding the Netanyahu family their personal tastes and lavish personal tastes to try to buy access to the political system. In the second case, case 2000, Netanyahu had a secret conversation with the head of what used to be Israel's largest newspaper, Yediot Ahronot. And that paper was pretty staunchly anti-Netanyahu. But in this conversation, Netanyahu seems to offer political concessions in exchange for the paper adopting a more favorable editorial tone. And this conversation was taped, by the way. And then the prosecutors got a hold of the tape. His defense was that – oh, I was never going to do it. I was just tricking this newspaper mogul. Except there were other examples of him trying to act on it and pursuing legislative ideas that would have significantly favored this newspaper, including trying to limit the circulation of one of its rivals.
I just have to say, you know, we did a segment a couple weeks back for Elsewhere talking about Netanyahu's son who was in trouble, right, for a conversation he had that was taped. I feel like they really, like the Netanyahu family, needs to just kind of maybe assume that they're being taped at all times and stop it. In that case, he was also like, no, I totally didn't say that. Oh, there's a tape? Oh.
Yeah, I think they should also understand at this point that almost everyone who's ever worked for Netanyahu tapes him and or hates him. And as soon as they quit, mysteriously, those tapes all leak. I mean, my favorite part of the tapes that Zach referred to was Netanyahu recommending columnists to be pro-Netanyahu to the publisher of this paper, Yediot Ahronot, and basically saying, hire them and I'll help you beat your biggest newspaper competitor. I mean, Jen, we were talking a little bit before this all started about sort of Bibi and media, Israel and media, the way the government tries to co-opt media, batter media, use media. I mean, it's, I think, a really cool thing about the story, a really interesting thing about the story.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating to me, like, looking at this. You know, when you think about the way Donald Trump kind of interacts with the media here in our country, there are a lot of similarities. It's not obviously a perfect comparison, right? But I think what's fascinating is you have this secret taped conversation of Bibi like behind the scenes saying like, hey, can I get some more favorable coverage? Meanwhile, you have Trump just like literally on Twitter saying, hey, can I get some more favorable coverage from everyone? And actively promoting Fox News as this like essentially this kind of Pravda state media pro-Trump kind of organization. But they also have these weird kind of personal relationships with media moguls. So, you know, Trump has this whole fake news and, you know, the fake news media hates me and blah, 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 blah. Except that he's really close with a lot of like media moguls. He was a reality TV star, right? So I think you see kind of similar kind of hints of the same relationship. It's obviously, you know, not a perfect comparison, but it's really similar in terms of the family corruption and the relationships with the media. It's just really fascinating. And Netanyahu has adopted the fake news slogan, right? Like, no, that's fake news. He even said that when the police came out and recommended that he be indicted. It was like, oh, it's fake news. It's going to be proven. So he's adopted that same kind of approach that Trump has.
Netanyahu has longstanding ties to the American right.
Right.
He lived here for a while. He worked here. And the joke among some Israelis is that he's the prime minister from the Republican Party. Like that kind of thing, the attitude that he adopts is very American in a lot of ways. And he takes ideas actively from the United States and has throughout his career.
Right. I mean, I want to bring this back, though, specifically to the media side and slightly more detail, because the other company, the other media company that was referenced on this call is itself really interesting. And Jen, you used the word Pravda. Pravda is actually often used in Israel to refer to this other company because it's a newspaper called Israel Hayom, Today in Israel, that was funded specifically by Sheldon Adelson. So the American billionaire, hyper-conservative, very pro-Israel, somebody who's given money, hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to the Republicans, big donor to Donald Trump. And it was funded because Bibi said, hey, I was getting hammered by the left-wing media. I need someone to support me. And Sheldon Adelson, an American, stepped in to support him. And Bibi on this call, the specific thing that he was trading with Yediot Ahronot was, I will help support a law designed specifically to harm Israel Hayom. So you've got this interesting dynamic where a newspaper is founded to help him. He is helped by that paper, but he's willing to then sell out that paper to another paper to help him get coverage. It's sort of this like meta sandwich, this like just extraordinarily circular thing where at the end of the day, all he wants is good coverage and he'll screw anybody he has to get that good coverage.
Right. The other thing about Israel Hayom is that it's free, whereas Yediot Ahronot is not free. And that illustrates really what's going on with it, right? This isn't Sheldon Adelson's attempt to build a media empire. It's the Israeli equivalent of a giant and extremely effective PAC.
Right. I think just also for a lot of Americans probably don't know a lot about the Israeli media landscape, understandably. But as someone who has interacted a lot with Israeli journalists, like I can kind of understand why Bibi would want some like more favorable coverage, because it's very similar to American journalists in the sense that they do not stop. Like they will not stop pushing and asking questions. They're sometimes way more even aggressive towards political candidates than any American journalist I've ever seen. So I remember being at a conference that I was helping host, and they had, you know, the panel of speakers up there, right? And these big prominent people giving their speech. And Israeli journalists are just standing up and interrupting them in the middle of the speech, in the middle of the panel. Like, no, that's wrong. Actually, I have a question. You wouldn't ever see an American journalist, like, they would wait till the end politely and do this kind of, okay, now it's a question and answer session. The Israeli press is vibrant, right? There's a strong kind of incredible journalistic kind of tradition there. I think it's just really important to note that. So, you know, when Bibi's saying, I need some help, yeah, like, I get that. Maybe you shouldn't probably buy off the media to do that.
I think, though, a difference, and it's a big one, and I agree that there's some similarities, but with Trump, it isn't simply that he would be having the equivalent. The apple to apple would be Donald Trump speaking to Marty Baron, let's say, or to Jeff Bezos and saying, hey, if the Washington Post gives me better coverage, I'll do something that helps Amazon or helps the Washington Post as a company. The difference, I think, is Trump is actively speaking to and getting policy advice from individual commentators on TV. Sean Hannity is a Trump advisor, which is scary. Laura Ingraham is basically a Trump advisor. Fox and Friends seems to be where he gets his intelligence, not, you know, actual U.S. intelligence. Bibi doesn't seem to do that. He's not getting advice from, like, Israeli right-wing commentators. But in a way, it's a lot more nefarious to me because Trump so far has not tried to change American law to get better coverage and benefit media cronies. Bibi has. And so we always focus here, you know, not surprisingly, on Sean Hannity and Trump, Fox and Friends and Trump. But the Bibi piece to me is a lot more disturbing.
In a more positive light, it looks like this may finally be the last straw for him, or at least there's a chance that it will be. Two of his top aides have turned state's evidence against him. One of them provided the tape that showed that this conversation with Yediot happened, right? Like he is in real trouble and in the kind of trouble that we haven't seen in his most recent tenure, right? Like there's a real chance he could not only lose his job as prime minister, but go to jail.
Yochi, you and I were talking about this when, you know, we first saw the reports that the police were going to recommend to the attorney general in Israel that they, you know, indict Bibi. And you were like, yeah, you know, they've been saying that over and over again, right? Like we've heard that. And Bibi has over and over said like, yeah, it's fake news. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen, right? So then the police actually did it. But even then, like, they're not the ones who make that decision. It's the attorney general. The huge question in Israel right now still is, will the attorney general choose to indict? And it's kind of like a will he or won't he. But the other day, he was at a conference, I think, giving a speech. And I can't remember if he was asked or if he just extemporaneously started talking about it. But he basically, you know, pushed back on Bibi's accusations that this was fake news, that these police were corrupt and all of that, and said, no, you know, they conducted this investigation with, you know, complete professionalism. They did it very well. They were creative. They were thorough. They did it completely by the book. So that was kind of a signal that a lot of people picked up on, like, uh-oh. He's the one that has to decide whether these recommended indictments should go through. And he's saying its investigation was done completely by the book and professionally. That seems to signal that maybe he would be going forward. So, I mean, it's gone from this kind of like vague theoretical Bibi's facing this threat to like this could actually happen soon.
If this happens, so the steps would be the Israeli attorney general actually goes forward with an indictment. Bibi is either convicted and or he quits. If he quits, it's titanic. I mean, if he quits, the ripple effect on Israel is massive, on the Mideast is massive, on the U.S. is massive. And if he quits, we will come back to this in significantly more detail. We will end there. As always, want to thank the brilliant Zach, the brilliant Jen.
The brilliant Yochi.
Thank you. My mom will smile in Chicago. I want to thank our engineer, Bridget Armstrong, our producer, Bird Pinkerton, our social media manager, Julie Bogan. If you like what you heard, we hope you did. Come find us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, any place else that you do get your podcasts. That's how we build the audience. Come find us at worldly@vox.com, #worldlypodcast on Twitter. We do just want to close with this. This was the first podcast we did without our friend Peter Leonard, who has been helping to produce and engineer this basically since we launched. A lot of the success that we've had, the audience that we've helped build, is because of Peter. He will be badly missed as a friend, badly missed as a colleague. It will be bigger and better things he goes to, but he will be missed here. So to Peter, thank you. And we will look forward to seeing what he does next.
We love you, Peter. Good luck.
Bye, Peter.